The date was the 30th of July of this year. The place was the Knesset in Jerusalem. At issue was a bill to amend the basic law of the State of Israel in four ways. The four parts of this bit of legislation were, first, that Jerusalem in its entirety shall be the capital of Israel. Secondly, that the government of Israel, the president of the State of Israel, the Knesset, and the Supreme Court shall meet in Jerusalem. Third, that the religious shrines of Jerusalem shall be protected from desecration, and that all people shall be guaranteed access. And fourthly, that a special government bureau should be established to see to the development of the city. Now, in legislative parlance, this law was what is called declaratory. That means that it changes nothing, but simply stipulates a certain national position. And as part of the basic law of Israel, it becomes part of essentially the constitution of the State of Israel. Jerusalem has been the capital of Israel since 1948. Many of you have visited the Knesset building in Israel. The Prime Minister, the President of the State of Israel, Supreme Court all meet in Israel, in Jerusalem. The shrines are protected and freedom of access is guaranteed. And there is a special department in being to oversee the development of the city. Moreover, in June of 1967, shortly after the Six-Day War, the Knesset passed several bills which in effect made Jerusalem part of the State of Israel. On that day, the 27th of June, 1967, a bill was passed by the Knesset which declared that the government could, as it wished, extend the laws, jurisdiction, and administration of the state to any part of the land of Israel declared to be land Israel by the Knesset. And that very same day, Jerusalem was so declared. And on that same day, a law was passed by the Knesset which said that the Minister of Interior could, by action, by fiat, extend the boundaries of any municipality. And that very same week, the Minister of Interior extended the boundaries of West Jerusalem to include East Jerusalem and a good bit of the environs. So the action of July 30th of this year changed nothing. And yet it unleashed a diplomatic furor of major proportions. The Egyptians canceled again their participation in the autonomy talks. The Security Council of the United Nations passed a resolution, Resolution 468, which declared Israel's actions null and void and requested that those countries which had embassies in Jerusalem withdraw them. 11 of the 13 countries which had such embassies withdrew them in the succeeding weeks. Only the Dominican Republic and Guatemala, two small countries, retained their embassies in Jerusalem. The World Council of Churches condemned Israel for its unilateral action. And the Pope and the Vatican surfaced again a plan that they had surfaced in the early 1940s for the internationalization of Jerusalem, with the church having a major role in the governance of the what they call the Holy City. The role of the United States in those actions and reactions was, to be kind, enigmatic. We have a democratic administration. Early in August, at their national convention, the Democratic Party platform included a plank which I quote, which recognizes and supports the established status of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and as a symbol of statehood, urges that the United States Embassy should be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Yet when this particular bill, act was put down in the Security Council to condemn Israel for its actions and to encourage the removal of all of the embassies, the United States abstained. Clearly, the United States government was aware that there would be a negative reaction in Israel and among Israel's friends throughout the world. Ambassador McHenry was not allowed to speak that day, but the Secretary of State, Mr. Muskie, was brought in. And the speech that he made seemed to indicate, until the final action, that the United States would, in fact, veto this resolution. For he called the resolution, and I quote, unbalanced and unrealistic. He said that we reject the resolution as a disruptive attempt to dictate to other nations. But then when the vote was cast, the United States simply abstained, and in fact, and allowing this resolution to become the law of the United Nations. And once the resolution was on the books, the power of the oil cartels and the Arab world came into play, forcing the countries that had embassies in Jerusalem to withdraw them. The Dutch foreign minister was quite specific. In an interview after he announced that Holland was removing her embassy from Jerusalem, and Holland was the only one of the European countries which retained an embassy in Jerusalem, he said very simply, we were threatened with a cancellation of $8 billion in commercial orders from the Arab world. We were told that the landing rights of our airlines, KLM, would be reviewed negatively by the Arab states. We were told that Rotterdam would no longer be a center for the retransmission of oil and gas to the rest of Europe, and we were told that our allocations of OPEC oil would be severely restricted. And the other countries that withdrew were all from Latin and South America, heavily Catholic countries which were reacting to the new interests of the papacy. Now, the papacy under John Paul II has been a very different thing than it was under his predecessor since Pope John. This pope is rigid in terms of church doctrine. If you've been following the news and the papers, you've recognized that he has resurrected the medieval sexual principles of the church in their full order and narrowness. But at the same time, he has recognized that the future of the church lies not in Europe or the United States, where the church is losing adherents, losing priests and religious to the modern secular way of thought, but in the third world, particularly in Latin and South America. And so he has aligned church policy with the liberation movements. Church priests have been very active throughout Latin and South America in the populist revolutions that are taking place throughout that part of the world. He has tried to align the church with the interests of the third world. And in so doing, insofar as Israel is concerned, he has resurrected the church interest in the internationalization of the Holy City. I would remind you that after the Second World War, when the whole question of Palestine was being debated before the United Nations, as the partition resolution began to develop, the Vatican put great pressure through its largely Catholic countries for the internationalization of the what they call the Holy City under what was then the Trusteeship Council of the United Nations. And in point of fact, in the resolution of November of 1947, which enabled the partition decision, Jerusalem was declared to be a corpus separatum, which is legal language for a separate entity. Jerusalem and the land running south and including Bethlehem was declared to be an international community under the authority of the United Nations. The Arabs rejected this proposal out of hand. The Transjordanian army attacked the Jewish settlements in and around Jerusalem. The Jews sent telegrams to the United Nations, you have authority over us, come now and protect us. These telegrams were never answered, and no United Nations soldier was ever sent to enforce a United Nations decision. 2% of the Jewish population of Jerusalem died in the 1947-48 war to protect their lives, their homes, their neighborhoods in the city. And once the war was over, that position in law which says that if you don't act to protect your property ceases to be yours, came into effect. Jerusalem was, in effect, divided, a divided city between the old city in Transjordanian hands, or Jordanian hands now, and the western city in Israeli hands. And this proposal to internationalize Jerusalem was forgotten. But the Vatican has a long memory. And in June of this year, the Vatican issued a long memorandum reviewing the history of Jerusalem and renewing its interest in the Holy City, declaring it to be sacred to all faiths, and therefore all faiths having a legitimate stake in determining its political future. We'll come back to that. Now, the question is why Israel passed a law in July of this year whose effect was nil. What was the purpose? And when you examine the history of this bit of legislation, the issue becomes, as Alice would say, curiouser and curiouser. In April of 1980, a private member of the Knesset introduced a bill which, after a number of permutations, became this law, which had two parts. It declared that Jerusalem shall be the capital of the state of Israel, and it defined Jerusalem as the municipality as it existed after the 1967 war. And it was very specific as to the boundaries and the borders of the state. Now, this law was introduced by a woman by the name of Geula Cohn. Geula Cohn is Israel's Madame Lafarge. You remember that woman in Dickens's Tale of Two Cities who loved to sit in the Tuileries by the guillotine knitting while the heads of the royalists were chopped off? She's a hawk among hawks. She withdrew from the Herut, from Menachem Begin's party, after the Camp David Accords because she claimed that Mr. Begin had given away parts of Eretz Yisrael, which he had no right to do. And she has been a one-woman, radical, chauvinist opposition. And the bill was introduced originally in order to embarrass the government and in order to prevent the government during the autonomy talks from doing anything which might reduce Israel's claims to full sovereignty over United Jerusalem. Now, how did the bill of such a member, a loner, become the basic law of the state after it was amended in various ways? The answer, I believe, lies not so much in Israel as in the pressures which have been exerted against Israel, again specifically in the area of Jerusalem these last months. In April of this year, the People's National Assembly in Egypt passed a bill which had two parts to it. The first part said that Jerusalem is part of the West Bank and should be considered along with the West Bank, what Mr. Begin calls Judah and Samaria, in the autonomy talks, rather than reserved for a special kind of decision. And secondly, declared that Jerusalem shall be the capital of a Palestinian sovereignty, that sovereignty which will be developed over the West Bank. Now, here was a state declaring Israel should be the capital of another state. The world protests that Israel must be internationalized and not the capital of Israel. But when the Egyptians passed this resolution, there were no protests, neither in the United Nations, nor in the United States State Department, nor anywhere else for that matter. But it was the beginning of a summer-long campaign which the Israelis saw as attempting to either redivide the city or to deny Israel any real sovereignty within it. That was the first act. The next was the passage by the Security Council of another of its innumerable anti-Israel resolutions. Again, it's a resolution which was, in which the United States abstained. In this resolution, which had the normal language, Israel was called upon to withdraw, as she's always been called upon, from various territories. The exact language was, from all occupied Palestine and all Arab territories, including Jerusalem. When this particular resolution was put down, the United States assured Israel that the language did not mean that Jerusalem was, like the West Bank, an area from which Israel had totally to withdraw. Israel has long since learned not to depend entirely upon the State Department's readings of international documents and was not prepared to accept this language. Then, as I suggested, there were the movements of the Vatican. And the Vatican attempt to resurface the whole question of a corpus separatum suggested to Israel that moves were afoot not only to divide the city, but to deny Israel any effective sovereignty within it. Because now the Arab world and the Soviet world was being joined by the Catholic world. And that's quite a group to gang up on you. And finally, there was the pressure to begin again the autonomy conference negotiations between Egypt and Israel, and the United States was pressuring Israel to make concessions, both on the West Bank and on the kind of issues that would be raised when Jerusalem would be discussed. And so, in a sense, the passage on July of this year of this amendment to the Basic Law was Israel's way of saying, go to hell. I won't be pushed any further. Now, gestures can have serious political consequences. And clearly, this one had consequences beyond what the present government in Israel expected. And yet, how could almost anyone in Israel, given those conditions, vote against this kind of bill, unless they have Solomonic wisdom and saintly patience? So the bill was passed, and the reaction took place, and nothing was changed, except the recognition that should be have become clear to all of us, that much of what the West has been saying about its concerns for Israel's legitimacy, its rights, sanctimonious talk, nothing else, that when push comes to shove, oil talks, business talks, power talks, and morality is a whisper. Because if I make the legal or the moral case, Israel's case for Jerusalem is impeccable. Israel did not ask for Jerusalem. Israel took the Western city when the United Nations failed to defend its own territory, when it was a question of defending lives or abandoning lives. Israel did not take East Jerusalem willingly. In 1967, when Mr. Nasser went to war against Israel, Israel sent message after message to King Hussein, stay out of the war. It's not your war. But Mr. Nasser was putting out false information about Egyptian victories, and Hussein saw his opportunity to take the whole place, and so he went to war. And he lost the city in war, a city which was never intended to be his in the first place. And the Israelis, as you recall, lost the majority of their casualties during the Six-Day War. There were 1,500 dead during that war. A majority of these were died taking the old city of Jerusalem because Israel refused to take heavy armor or heavy cannon and use it against the city. They took the city with rifles and with lives. They paid for it with blood. The city is Israel's because other governing bodies defaulted on their obligations to preserve the peace or to protect the place. And I would remind you also that in terms of access to the holy places, that issue which the church is raising again, the Jews are the only ones who have guaranteed the sanctity of the holy places and the ease of freedom of access to them. Between 1948 and 1967, Jews couldn't get into the Old City. There were 58 synagogues in the Old City of Jerusalem, and every single one of them was desecrated during that period. And as you well know, the graveyards on the Mount of Olives were desecrated, and the tombstones were used for paving, for the sides of movie theaters, for a whole variety of ignoble uses. Indeed, when you look back in time, you find something that interesting, that over the thousands of years, Jews have been the only ones who have protected the holy places of non-Jews in the city of Jerusalem. It's interesting. When the temple was destroyed by the Romans, they leveled it, and they built on the Temple Mount a temple to Jupiter. And when the Roman Empire became Christian, under Constantine, a few emperors later, they leveled the pagan temple and they built there a church. And when the Arabs conquered Jerusalem, they leveled the church and they built a mosque. And when the Crusaders conquered Jerusalem, they leveled the mosque and they built a church. And when the Arabs reconquered Jerusalem, they leveled the church and they built the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Only the Jews protected the mosque, protected the Dome of the Rock. Only the Jews have seen to the freedom of access to the holy places and have even given sovereignty of those places to the religious orders and the countries from which they come. And again, when you look back over history, you find something interesting. That only the Jews have been concerned with Jerusalem as a capital. Jerusalem was a Jebusite city until David conquered it. And David made it his own. It was called in the Bible Kiryat David, the city of David, because it was between the two warring kingdoms, the northern and the southern kingdom, Israel and Judah. Let him stay out of these internecine quarrels and yet somehow rule the country. And it was for 1,000 years the Jewish capital. But when the Romans conquered Israel, they took the capital and they went down to the coast and they made their capital Caesarea. And when the Arabs conquered that part of the world, their capital was in Damascus and in Baghdad, not in Jerusalem. And when the Byzantines returned, the Byzantines ruled from Constantinople, not from Jerusalem. And when the Crusaders came in, their center of power was in Antioch, not in Jerusalem. And the Turks had their provincial center in Beirut, not in Jerusalem. Only the Jews have been interested in Jerusalem as the center of their national life. A Muslim in Jerusalem may consider it a holy city, but he prays in the Al-Aqsa Mosque facing Mecca, not Jerusalem. It is only the Jews for whom politically, socially, and religiously, Jerusalem is the center. And Zionism, that movement of the last century to reestablish the national home in Palestine, takes its name from Jerusalem, from Mount Zion, from the Temple Mount. It's not Palestinianism or Israelism, it's Zionism with a focus on Jerusalem. Next year in Jerusalem is a phrase by which the messianic hope is expressed at the end of a Seder night. The legal credentials of the Jews to Jerusalem are impeccable. Jews, when they have been in control in Jerusalem, have been careful of the rights of others. We were not allowed to go into the eastern city to visit the old synagogues, to go to the western wall. But the minute Israel conquered Jerusalem, it became a united city, and the Arabs in the city were allowed to retain their Jordanian passports, yet vote in in Jerusalem's municipal elections, and though they were Jordanian citizens, sit on the municipal council of the city. All of the electrical, the telegraphic, the sewage, the water services which were in West Jerusalem were immediately extended to Eastern Jerusalem, which the Arabs had never provided for. Care was spent to protect the holy places. If you've been in Jerusalem, you know that there are Israeli soldiers at the doors of all the holy places to make sure that there is freedom of access and that no one is barred. It's a very different thing when Jews are in Jerusalem than when any other people are there. were the least chauvinist of all of the religious groups. But in the world of power, in the world of oil, in the world as it is, this means very little, I'm afraid. And we've seen, again, the playing out of this scenario this last summer. If I had been in Israel, and if I were a member of the Knesset, and if I had any wisdom, I would have voted against the, or abstained at least, from this basic law. It was a necessary gesture. But the world's reaction to it is very important, important to understand. It says that the years ahead are going to be difficult years for Israel, Jews. I remember not so long ago in this very room when soon-to-be President Ford was speaking to a group, and when he said that the Republican Party ought to be dedicated to moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Some of you may have been here. But when he became president, there was no such move. And if you look back in history and ask yourself why the American embassy is in Tel Aviv and not in Jerusalem, the answer is that the State Department in 1948 was worried about the Vatican, was worried about how the Catholic world would react given its interest in Israel as a corpus separatum. And if you ask why the move was not made later, it's because of the Arab world, because it would be seen as a tilt in favor of Israel. The Israelis are saying, we won't be pushed any further. Jerusalem must remain united. Jerusalem will remain our capital. Those who amended Gula Cohn's original submission did so in order to make it as vague as possible to allow some area for negotiation. What does it mean, Jerusalem united? What does sovereignty mean in relationship to the city? There are many ways in which these terms can be understood and negotiated, and obviously there will have to be some negotiation. But the world must learn that one of the facts of political life is that no government in Israel could survive who would deal away the city, and that the country will go down fighting rather than have Jerusalem torn out of its body politic. Now, if one reverses the coin and looks to the Arab world and says, why the interest in Jerusalem? The answer is in part religious, particularly among the Saudis, who have been preaching jihad, holy war against Israel on the basis of its control of Jerusalem. And partially it's geopolitical. If you look at a map of Israel, you notice that the West Bank is divided into two hemispheres, which hardly touch because there's Jerusalem just in the middle. There is the old Israel over here, Samaria, Bethel, Nablus, and over here Hebron and Bethlehem. And Jerusalem is across the high road, which links these two parts of the West Bank. And so there is concern that there be freedom of access. There is legitimate concern that this entity, whatever it is that emerges, will be able to think of itself and act as a single cohesive country. And certainly those are legitimate concerns which will somehow have to be adjusted. But at the same time, no country in the world has the right, no religious group in the world has the right to tell Israel that Jerusalem may not be your capital. No country in the world has the right to say that internationalization is a solution to the problems of that part of the world, because internationalization has not worked for any city in any part of the world for any length of time. Jerusalem will remain a body of contention between Israel and the West, as well as between Israel and the East and the Arab world, because the West would like these problems to go away, and Israel's not about to go away. What's for it then? Well, you know my old theory that all problems have solutions. And I'm not so sure that Jerusalem offers a solution. The State Department has long been of the belief that the issues of Jerusalem ought to be left to last, till all possible arrangements have been made about the West Bank, about Gaza, then let's deal with Jerusalem. In some ways, I think it's good that the issue surfaced early, because there are certain irreducible positions in any bargaining. There's a certain point, if you're bargaining with another businessman and he won't give on that point, you walk away. Treaties are made to be broken. It is not the worst thing that could ever happen to peace in the Middle East if no final treaty were to exist between Egypt and Israel. But if Egypt and Israel are both convinced that their future lies with the West, there's nothing to be gained by further involvement in the internecine quarrels of the Arab world, then there may be peace for a period of time. Because Syria and Jordan cannot make war against Israel successfully on their own. And so we may have peace without a treaty. And we may have peace without a final adjustment of the situation in Jerusalem. And I'm firmly convinced that our State Department and others would be well advised to take the issue of Jerusalem off of the issue of diplomatic items which must be dealt with, and allow time to pass, the situation to evolve. The Middle East is changing. Who would have believed 6 months ago when this whole brouhaha started that Iraq and Iran would be at war with each other, and the Arab world would be preoccupied with a kind of Protestant-Catholic squabble of bitter proportions. That's the fact. The Arab world is not of a piece. The real issues in the Arab world are not the issues between themselves and Israel, but the issues between poverty and wealth, between the oil-less countries and the oiled countries, between radical revolution and feudalism, between an Islam which is totally medieval, and the obvious need of Islam to come to grips with some of the values of the modern world. If you face the question of Jerusalem directly, there is no answer. Israel will not give, and the other countries cannot take. If you allow time to pass, perhaps Israel will cease to be the problem that it seems to be today. Another pope will come. Other attitudes will emerge. Open borders may exist between Israel and Egypt. A new balance of power may come into being in that part of the world, and Israel may simply recede as one of the problems which really must be dealt with. Because I'm not convinced, when all is said and done, that Mr. Sadat cares that much about Jerusalem. He cares about Jerusalem because the Saudis care and are to his right and are and always endanger him by saying, you're not Arab enough. But it's really not a primary concern of his. He wants the oil of the Sinai. He wants the bases in the Sinai. He wants the support of the United States. And I'm not convinced that Syria cares that much about Jerusalem. She cares about the Golan. It's another story. But Jerusalem is not her primary concern. And I'm not so sure that Hussein really believes any longer that he can recapture the West Bank. Hussein has enough problems staying alive within his own little borders. And it's not at all clear what kind of autonomy will develop in the West Bank and what kind of relationship that autonomy will have with Israel, because whatever entity comes into being in the West Bank will be dependent upon Israel for employment, for the prosperity of its economy, and for access to the sea. And arrangements on that level will be a give and take, a quid pro quo. And that kind of arrangement and negotiation has not even begun. And in those arrangements, there's real room for bargaining over what happens in terms of life within Jerusalem. Jerusalem cannot be redivided unless you took dynamite and you dynamited away the entire new city which has emerged in the last 15 years. It's a city which now is a crescent moon around the old city. It's a city in which there are three Jews for every Arab. It's a city which is entirely geared towards Israel, for its economy, for its standard of living, for its schooling, for its government. New facts have come into being, which did not exist before. And the Arabs know this as well as the Israelis. There was a great battle about 8 months ago between the PLO and the citizens of East Jerusalem. The PLO insisted that the citizens of East Jerusalem must have nothing to do with Israeli utilities and services. And the citizens of East Jerusalem insisted that they could not do without the Israeli telephone system and the Israeli electrical system. And they would not give up those utilities, and they did not give them up. And what I'm saying simply is, as these new situations, these new concrete situations come into being, then I think there will be a modus vivendi come into being, which will allow for some measure of peace. But until then, on a political level, if you're arguing sovereignty, no hope, no solution, best forgotten. Jerusalem is perhaps my favorite city in the world. It's a beautiful town. That rose-colored stone shining in the morning light, there's nothing like it. It's a town which reminds me always of impressionistic painting. You see the surface, and you know that there's more below the surface. And when they show you history, it's never quite the history they show you, but it's historical. And it touches all that has to do with this faith of ours and Western civilization generally. And it sits high, and the air is still fairly clean, and there's a silence which is moving to the city. It's a beautiful place. It's a place which ought to have had an easier history, an easier time of it. It hasn't had, it may not have. But Jerusalem has survived, and we have survived, and Jerusalem will survive, and will survive as the capital of the state. Amen.